It's the morning show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court decision yesterday in favor of a cake maker's refusal to make a cake for the wedding of two men. What are the implications of the ruling on future rulings? Where is that line between freedom to practice my religion versus freedom to be treated equally? And what was the narrowness of this ruling? Robin Fretwell Wilson is a professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law, where she directs the college's Family Law and Policy Program and the Epstein Health Law and Policy Program. Well, Robin, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Carrie. I appreciate it.
First of all, when you heard about this ruling, what was your initial reaction?
Well, my initial reaction is I need to dig into this decision. I think everybody thought that there would be something really staggering here. I think many people have experienced it as disappointed, as like not too much to see, let's move on. But I actually think there is something really staggering here, which is a new script for a kind of pluralism in America that Kennedy envisions and he sees within our grasp.
And what does this pluralism look like to Kennedy?
Well, you know, in effect he says that there should be no disparagement either of religious folks for their views about marriage or of LGBT persons, that it's unacceptable in America today for us to diss each other for our religious beliefs, exclude each other from the marketplace for our sexuality. And in a sense, he's sort of written the outline for, ironically, legislation, right? The kinds of things that states are grappling with today when they think about how do we reconcile two competing values that are dear to all Americans, you know, that we're treated with respect, that every person can be true to who they are.
So I'll get back to the specifics of this ruling in a minute. If you have comments about this ruling, please call us 800-642-1234, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. I want to start with some background on this case. Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Two men came in and said, hey, we're getting married, and we would like you to make us a cake. And the cake maker didn't say, get out of here, I'm not doing business with you. The cake maker said, buy a cake from me, but I am not putting my personal creativeness into creating a cake for you. That's a step too far for me in terms of my religious beliefs, correct?
That's right. He declined to make a cake because, and then he asserts a number of views. One is free exercise of religion, that it would impede his ability to sort of be true to his own faith, even if it is in the public sphere. That's ultimately where the court comes down, although not on a broad announced principle like that. We can talk about the narrowness in a moment. And then he says something separate, which is that I have creative expression and it shouldn't be used to basically endorse something that I can't endorse. And the court notably does not go there.
Right. We'll talk about where the court goes in a moment. We're taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. I'm getting lots of things here. We're going to reconnect with Robin because that connection was kind of problematic and we couldn't really hear her that well. But we would like to hear from you also, 800-642-1234. Or ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. You can also, if you're on Facebook, you know, we were just talking about technology addiction. But if you're on Facebook, you can go to the Ideas Network page and ask your question or leave your comment there. Robin, are you back? Robin is not back. So the fascinating thing to me about this, which we will talk about once Robin does come back on the line, is that this was a 7-2 decision written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. That means that there were at least two so-called liberals, and I hate to say there are conservatives and liberals on the courts because I really just want to call them judges. They're justices. But two people who sort of lean more liberal actually went with this case. And I want to find out what the reasoning was there. If you have read about this case. If you are, if you were expecting something else, and you were really shocked yesterday that that wasn't the answer, as Robin seems to have been, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. And we are still waiting for Robin to rejoin us. What was your reaction to this? Is there a line? I mean, that's the thing that I find kind of fascinating. Robin, are you there?
I am.
Yay. Oh, and you sound so much better. Thank you. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
So let's go there. Is there, you said that the decision did not, specifically did not say he has a right to refuse, that a cake maker or a dressmaker or any sort of creative person, any person, has a right to refuse serving someone who is gay or perhaps who is Muslim or whatever. It specifically actually affirmed the rights of LGBT people. What did this ruling say?
Well, I think, as you noted for just a moment, it didn't say that we have such broad expressive rights that we can refuse to do business or commerce with particular people. And imagine what that world would have looked like, Carrie, had they, right? So it wouldn't have been limited to LGBT rights or these collisions around faith and sexuality. It could have been any view held by any person that you might stumble on in any context. And so you could see why the court might have been grasping for a narrow ground. Mm-hmm. What was the narrow ground? In effect, Kennedy takes to task the decision-making, the actual adjudication of the question under anti-discrimination law in Colorado. And as you noted, I think, you know, the law says that you can't discriminate against people in the public accommodations world, i.e. restaurants and businesses and public spaces, based on nothing more than their sexual orientation or their gender identity. And in that adjudication, he says that all people, including people of faith, are entitled to fair and neutral treatment. That's one of the background principles of free exercise. You know, the court's been very clear over time in a case called Smith, which was the peyote decision. But, you know, they basically said we can't allow religious believers to become a law unto themselves. And so if states want to pass neutral, generally applicable laws that happen to burden religious people differently or more, then it can do that all day long. But what it can't do is it cannot target religious people. It can't treat them unfairly. And Kennedy takes to task the decision-making in Phillips' specific case and says, yeah, he wasn't treated fairly.
So he wasn't treated fairly, Kennedy says, because the people on the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, at least a couple of people from what I understand, made disparaging remarks in Kennedy's view about the cake maker's specific religion. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Not just a specific religion. I think maybe they didn't go that far. They said his specific view, which is, I don't want to facilitate a same-sex marriage. I can't endorse that. That's not my view of marriage, he says, which he would have seen Phillips as between one man and one woman. And then they go a step further, and they say, you know, religion's been trotted out over the eons to do all kinds of things like justify the Holocaust or justify slavery.
Right.
And in effect, they're saying, yeah, in your view, Phillips, that's no different than this. And I think it was that last point. It's no different than this. It's disparaging of his view. And let me pause and bracket for a second. I have a new book called The Contested Place of Religion and Family Law, post-Obergefell, post-Hobby Lobby. And one of the things that we note in the book is that 51% of Americans, a slim, slim majority of Americans today, they share Phillips's view. So imagine what it would have felt like to those Americans to be told that their view of marriage is no different than somebody who stood up for the Holocaust, right, or who thinks slavery is fine.
Right.
I think that was a really tough spot for the court, too, because, you know, these are widely held beliefs. In the words of many LGBT rights advocates that I work with, to try to find what I call peaceful coexistence laws where we can reconcile values, you know, those advocates that I work with say that those are respectable views. They don't agree with them. They don't want those to guide public policy and exclude them from marriage, but they see them as respectable. And the court is very much coming down on that.
We are taking your calls about the Supreme Court decision yesterday. It's a very narrow ruling that affirms that Jack Phillips, a Colorado baker, could deny, in this particular case, to bake a cake for the wedding of two men. Call us at 800-642-1234. And we're going to be back with our guest, Robin Fretwell Wilson, in a moment. It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 in favor of a cake maker who refused to bake a cake for the wedding of two men. The ruling was narrow, though, and experts are having a hard time seeing it as a precedent for future civil rights cases. What is your reaction to this ruling? Should business owners, such as the bakery owner, have the ability to turn customers away? What if, in making rulings, government officials make disparaging remarks? Does that make a difference? Anthony Kennedy said it did. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Robin Fretwell Wilson, we were just talking about the narrowness of the decision and the fact that people made disparaging remarks. Within this decision, Kennedy does not say, and by the way, you can't sell to people based on their beliefs, right?
Say the last part.
You can't sell to people based on your beliefs. You can't discriminate against who you want to sell to because they may be different from you or violate your religious beliefs, correct?
Yeah, no, I think he absolutely is saying we do business with each other in America. You know, he says in particular, no law should treat LGBT persons as social outcasts or inferior in dignity and worth. Now, let me pause and say, Carrie, we have a big task ahead of us in America. I did a calculation last night. You know, across two-thirds of the land mass of America, there is no public accommodations non-discrimination law for
right.
LGBT persons. That's what's at stake here. And Kennedy is sort of helping lawmakers, you know, not his colleagues on the court necessarily, but legislators in state houses. He's helping them write a script for a new pluralism that says we do business with each other. But those folks who have strongly held religious beliefs, those religious and philosophical objections, I'm reading from the decision here, to gay marriage are protected views. And so I think he's laying down a challenge to America that we have to find a way to reconcile both of those values.
Now, Utah did this, and Utah seems to have done it correctly, in your opinion, right?
Yes, but a little disclosure, I had the privilege of assisting the Utah legislature as it enacted the Utah Compromise. But let me just say for a second, Utah did. You know, Utah was, at the time, the single most conservative state politically in America. It's the second most religious state in America today. And it gave more rights in housing and hiring to the full LGBT community than that community had in New York at the time. It can be done. This reconciliation can be done. And, you know, Kennedy sort of sketches some broad outlines for how we should do it. And one of them starts with, I think, we have to protect LGBT persons from being kicked out of restaurants and bars and other places that all of us feel like we can just sort of take for granted. And it turns out not all of us can. So that has to be a minimum piece of this. And I think then it becomes incumbent upon us as a people to figure out, well, what does that mean for the people of faith who have a different view? And it can't mean what those Colorado commissioners took it to mean, which is, you know, the public square. It's so important that we protect gay people that your view now is disfavored. You can get out. That's not a good view of the public square either. Has to be one. And Kennedy is so consistent through the decision about this. Every single line is almost a parody claim if you go back and reread them. Not only can we not disparage
LGBT persons and treat them differently because of who they are, that would be undignified, and it would, you know, kind of get at their inherent dignity as persons. But we can't do that to religious people either, he said.
Thomas from Milwaukee is joining us. Welcome to the program, Thomas.
Hi, good morning, ladies. Yeah, I think your guest is right. I would read this as almost the reverse of what people think it is. It is really a slap on the finger of people who there in Colorado were pretty anti-Christian, pretty hostile. In fact, as from what I read, they hid the fact that they made those pretty terrible remarks in the minutes and pulled some other shenanigans. And I think it speaks to this idea that Christians in general, you know, people forget that that's also a protected class. I mean, you had the incident in Seattle where the Christians were kicked out of the local coffee shop. You have it at the highest levels of government. You have people like Bernie Sanders, you know, not wanting to confirm people for posts because of their religious beliefs about traditional marriage, et cetera, even though they say, you know, we'll follow the law. So I think it's really a wake-up call that if we're going to live in a pluralistic society, that includes protected classes like Christians, believe it or not. So I think that's really the takeaway from this.
Thank you very much, Mark. I want to ask you, Robin, did the Colorado Commission try to hide their remarks in the minutes?
You know, I'd have to go back and look. And I always, you know, I think it was Thomas's point well that, you know, we need to protect everyone, including classes that we might naturally and actually historically have taken a dim view of. So, you know, people of faith have been discriminated against, as well as LGBT persons, from the beginning of our enterprise as a common people. So, but I do worry about words like shenanigans, you know, and I have to go back and look much more carefully at whether they, quote, hid anything. Those are very strong terms.
Right.
I don't know whether the support is there in the record, but I do know this. Kennedy was very clear that when a commissioner dissed Phillips's views as just completely out of bounds, as not worthy of respect, as no different than, you know, stepping up for the Holocaust, that went too far.
So is it possible
yeah.
that if the commissioners had not made those kinds of statements, that the ruling would have gone a different way?
Oh, I think it's absolutely possible. In fact, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Shannon Minter yesterday, was one of my dialogue partners on the project about tolerance. You know, he said there's nothing to see here because this is just the application of, as I said, the Smith decision and later decisions about free exercise. You don't get to target religious people. That's been in our law for a very long time. One thing in particular that Kennedy says, which I thought was very interesting, is he says, we don't know what would have happened if the court or state officials had weighed the state's interest in shielding, quote, gay persons from indignity when they seek services and goods in an open market against Phillips's sincere religious objection. If they had done that in a neutral way, as free exercise guarantees demand, we might have seen a very different outcome on the specific outcome with respect to this paper.
So I'm fascinated by the fact that this was a 7-2 vote. We are used to 5-4 decisions in the Supreme Court. Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer concurred, though they wrote their own concurring opinion. What were their reasons for concurring?
Well, Kagan, I think, says, you know, yeah, it did go too far to make these specific comments, and it deprived Phillips of neutral treatment by the state as to his religion. Now, they also wrote separately, though, because they were not completely down with the majority opinion. One particular piece of the majority opinion is the sort of, I call them sort of strike suits, but, you know, the purchases by a man who, you know, wanted cakes that had terrible verses on them from the Bible, or things that people would see as terrible sentiments on them, but taken faithfully from the Bible. And three bakers had refused to do those cakes for him. And Kennedy, in the majority decision, makes a lot of hay out of the fact that Phillips didn't get the same treatment as those three bakers. Kagan, writing separately, says she just doesn't think that that is important to this. She didn't think that he got wrongfully treated vis-a-vis the other bakers. And partly that's a big fight between Alito and Kagan about what was the refusal. Kagan says it was a refusal to make a cake that you would make for someone else, i.e. the wedding cake is like, you know, beautiful cake with three tiers and nice icing and a little thing on top. And you were going to make that cake for a heterosexual couple that walked in, Carrie, and so you have to make that cake for the gay couple. That's what Kagan's getting at. You know, and Gorsuch, I said Alito a moment ago, I apologize, but Gorsuch, you know, sort of says, that's not right. You know, he was saying he wouldn't make a cake for anyone either. And then they have this fight about levels of sort of specificity and moving up this ladder of specificity. But they're fighting about whether Phillips, in fact, would have made the cake for other people.
We are joined by Mark from Franklin. Mark, welcome to the program. No, Mark doesn't seem to be there. Anne from Monona, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I have a cold, so my voice doesn't sound very good.
I hear you.
I wondered, I think this is actually a dangerous precedent, and whether it's considered or labeled narrow or not, I think it will be used as precedent, and it could widen very quickly. And I wondered what Christian religion the baker is a member of, and whether there was any Supreme Court questioning of the baker about the specific beliefs his religion requires. I think religion here is being used as a pretext for, you know, for discrimination, and I think because this is the commercial, you know, he could lose customers this way, too. But I basically have not heard anything about Supreme Court questioning about the religious beliefs he apparently ascribes to.
You know, I thank you very much, Anne. I appreciate that. Robin, I think that there are a lot of people who think that this decision was a decision about religion versus gay rights. It wasn't. It was a decision about openly discriminating, openly saying disparaging things while commissioners were holding a hearing. Correct? Are we not missing anything here?
No, but look, I mean, I think Anne raises the really hard question, right? It's like, you know, the elephant in the room that gets missed in the decision. And, you know, she's absolutely right. There is many people feel like, okay, if Phillips gets to take a pass, you know, by cloaking himself in a religious belief, then let's interrogate that religious belief. And one of the things that's really unfortunate in this whole area is that's just an impossibility. In fact, the court cites this case called Thomas Arms. And Thomas Arms is really interesting because it's a case about a Jehovah's Witness who worked at an arms factory. When he worked at one part of the factory where he wasn't making, you know, steel that directly went into arms, and he was fine with that. And then he got moved over to this other section, and he didn't want to do that. And he individually quits his job. And the question ends up becoming one of whether he was entitled to unemployment, unemployment benefits, excuse me. And one of the things that the court says is, you know, the fact that other Jehovah's Witnesses were willing to work on the steel that went directly into the arms doesn't say anything about Thomas. But it's Thomas's honest belief. It's Thomas's view. Now, if you stop for a second and think about that, that is a really individualistic view of religious belief. It's not about whether the Catholic Church believes what you believe as an individual member of the Catholics say about something deeply contested like birth control. Right, because lots of Catholics, for example, you know, use birth control, but the official position of the church might be that, you know, we're not fine with that. And so, you know, in some sense, this we don't interrogate whether he's a member, to use Anne's words, of a specific belief and what his religion actually required, evinces a kind of deep respect for individuals to sort of form their own views and go their own way vis-a-vis God.
Okay, so I have a hypothetical.
Well, yeah.
What if a Christian baker or Christian dressmaker is somebody comes in who is wearing a hijab, and wants him to make her a dress for a particular religious ceremony. And he says to her, I can't do that because I think that your religion is wrong. Where would the Supreme Court come down on that, do you think? What's the law?
Well, I don't think that we have an answer to that out of this decision. And that's in part because of the line that I read a few minutes ago, but the one that said, you know, could have went different in Colorado.
Right.
They could have actually weighed the state's interest in shielding, here it says gay persons, but read Muslims, and you were hypothetical, from indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market. And they say they could have engaged in this lane, but they didn't engage in this lane because they went after Phillips for what they considered a disfavored view. Now, your point is, what happens if we weigh that? And I think we have to pause and remember that we're treating Muslims very badly across America, right? And there are times when we have to reach as a people to do better by one another and to remember the humanity of each of us. So it wouldn't be surprising that a law, in all of our laws, I think in the United States, I'll have to go back and check this, but they make religion an illicit ground for treating people differently. And so if the Christian dressmaker would have made a dress for any other person, then, you know, it seems hard to understand that refusal is about anything other than a protected characteristic of that person, i.e. their faith. Now, when it goes to be adjudicated, because this decision comes down very hard on the fact that the process for deciding whether Phillips, you know, had violated CADA, the anti-discrimination law, that was sort of infected with animus. But if it had not been, and if they say something like, we really do believe in our community Muslims are being excluded, we see this as nothing different than refusing to provide a good that you would have provided to any other person, and although we're not disparaging your view about another faith tradition in America, our sense of inclusion and citizenship means that we're all served in public. If the discussion had gone like that, I don't see them having stepped over the desire of the state to protect people from discrimination in public places.
We're going to go to Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, it just seems like we've jumped the shark with this whole discrimination in relation to buying product. You know, businesses should have the same rights that our actors and entertainers have to have free association and buy and service people that they want to service. We're not fighting the same battles that we fought in the 40s, the 50s, and under Jim Crow. Let's have businesses have the same rights as every entertainer does, which means free association. If I want to sell you product and you want to buy it, so be it. If you don't, so be it. Get government out.
Robin, what do you say to that? That I think that what Steve is saying, and thank you for your call, Steve, I think that what he is saying is that businesses should be able to sell to people who they want to sell to or not sell to people who they don't want to sell to without any sort of rules.
Well, okay, so let's go backwards for just a second, because Steve invoked both free association but also our experience in the 40s and 50s, which I took as a reference to our racial non-discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in effect, he wants to make an analogy to the freedom that other people, individual people who don't have shop fronts, who are not present on Main Street, entertainers. Because they're like, you know, baseball players, or like free contract, you know, people that just work out in the world. They don't have a shop front that you stumble into. So he's making an analogy to them and asking, why do we give them all of this freedom that we don't want to give to a Jack Phillips who's equally creative, perhaps?
Okay, so I'm going to have to let you answer this question when we come back from break. We're talking about the Supreme Court's decision yesterday in favor of a cake maker who refused to create a cake for a wedding between two men. We're going to dig a little more and ask about this question. Is there still discrimination that our caller brought up? This is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about yesterday's Supreme Court decision in favor of a cake maker who refused to bake a cake for the wedding of two men, with our guest, Robin Fretwell Wilson. Call us at 800-642-1234 to give us your take or ask your question about this ruling. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings or email at ideas@WPR.org. So, Robin, I want to get back to the question that you started answering before the break, and thank you for being patient on this. The caller said that actors who are who deal with people not in, in a storefront, who just kind of make deals with people to do particular work, actors and entertainers are free to decide not to work with somebody because of their religious beliefs, and that storekeepers aren't, and that these are two different rules. Talk to me about that.
Well, you know, I think Steve makes a really important point that I wanted to drive home. When we regulate public accommodations, we're regulating specific places that we think have significance or import. We're not regulating individuals. And if you look at the, so we regulate, if you want to think of it shorthand, the business, but not the individuals in it. And so if you think about, you know, our classic civil rights laws, they were in very narrow silos, like literally the 1964 Civil Rights Act covered gas stations, entertainment venues, hotels, common carriers, basically like taxis, and then sit-down restaurants, not takeout restaurants. And even within the 1964 Civil Rights Act, we never would have reached this business, you know, the Phillips business, because Congress made a finding that there was no discrimination in retail shops. And the states like Colorado and California that have taken that sort of very narrow silo approach and expanded it to cover almost any business open to the public still are anchored for the most part to storefronts. Now, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because there's surprise and dislocation that sort of happens. Like, I walk into one place and I'm told get out, and then I walk into another and I'm told, yeah, fine. And I'm never going to know from moment to moment, you know, which place is which. And so I think anchoring the storefronts in the world is important. You know, there's a set of cases that talk about if you work from your home, then we're not reaching you. So, for example, some of the wedding vendors we never talk about, think about a woman who sings at a wedding. You know, some states have explicitly said she's just not covered. Doesn't matter.
Interesting.
What the anti-discrimination law says. So Steve's right in the sense that when it's been an individual actor without a storefront, we have let them be. But the storefront is different because people are walking down Main Street and they need to know from moment to moment whether they're going to be served. And I think there's one more piece that's really important to Steve's question, and it's something that Kennedy says about stigma. But he puts some guardrails around the way that we should reconcile these two interests, that we, you know, don't disparage religious people and we don't discriminate against gay folks. And he says that, you know, the exceptions cannot be so unbounded that they result in, quote, community-wide stigma, inconsistent with the history and dynamics of civil rights laws. Well, those laws were to break up basically, you know, wholesale, you know, decisions by businesses on Main Street not to serve African Americans. And so he says that, and he goes on to say, and if we didn't put up these guardrails, it would be no different than, quote, putting up signs saying no goods or services will be sold if they be used in gay marriages, something that would impose a serious stigma. So I think the key here is if it's a business on Main Street and they're basically as a cartel all saying, no, we're not going to help you with your gay wedding, it kind of turns us back to where we were before Obergefell, and that's bad. But if it's individuals, you know, that aren't carrying that, the law itself actually tends not to regulate that.
That's really fascinating. That's fascinating. I want to get to, though, something that's maybe sort of like a right turn here in terms of this case. According to the ruling, it was the commissioner's comments on the case that conveyed, as we have talked about, hostility towards Phillips' sincere religious beliefs that made Kennedy decide what he decided. And this kind of fascinates me because what he is setting up is if a public official in the course of a hearing, or perhaps in the course of a campaign, or perhaps in a tweet, says disparaging things about somebody's religion and then rules against somebody, and it makes and it feels like they are ruling against their religion, then those disparaging things can be used in a court decision, even if the person followed the law exactly. Does this make sense to you? I mean, this has wider implications for other things that might be coming up in front of the Supreme Court in a year or two.
Well, yeah, I mean, in one sense, I see your point, Carrie. I mean, you kind of worry if we're not instructing people how to be more careful and, let's just say, sneaky about what they're really trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is an element of that. And I hope this is not what people take from this decision. I think there's also another sense in which, you know, he is trying to say that even as we adjudicate these very difficult questions in our society about how to peacefully coexist, we can't be trashing each other and taking a respectable view and labeling it as off limits as a way to deal with what's a hard question.
Is he specifically laying out the groundwork for how the court might look at the Trump's travel ban?
On that, I don't know. But I do want to say one thing that I think is a parallel, Carrie, that may not have occurred to you. You know, after Obergefell, we had a number of judges who said they didn't want to marry folks.
Right.
They didn't want to be the agent of marrying them. Now, my position has always been no one can be a choke point on the path to marriage. In other words, people can step to the side, perhaps, and be staffed around, but they cannot block other people from their rights. But one of the things that was really important in two states in particular, Louisiana and Ohio, is they said when a public official announced a rule that they were not going to marry gay folks, they had to get out of marriage for everybody. Otherwise, it would appear that they were tainted. And what happens if a case comes before the court on which they sit that implicates LGBT rights? Now, imagine how that would feel as a gay person. You'd be like, what the heck is that? This is the judge who said they wouldn't marry folks,
right?
And now they're deciding my case? So in a sense, this is parallel to Phillips's experience. He's like, wait a minute. And Kennedy says it was not unreasonable that he would believe. Remember that language? Not
right.
Unreasonable that he would believe that he was treated badly. Now, you know, Ginsburg, in dissent, makes a really important point. She's like, oh, my God, this went up and down, like the decision-making tree. There are like five different bodies that weighed in on this. This wasn't just one set of folks.
Robin, we could talk about this for another couple of hours, but I've got to cut you off. Thank you for joining us to talk about this. We're going to revisit this. We're going to revisit with you this issue. This is a very in-depth issue, and we had a lot of callers. Thank you for being with us. Next up in our series looking at 10 Democratic gubernatorial candidates is Matt Flynn. He's been a Democratic Party insider and contender for 40 years, but he's never won. Let's introducing him from Sean Johnson.
Matt Flynn is a Navy veteran, the former chair of the state Democratic Party, and a longtime attorney for a major Milwaukee law firm. He's also the face of the marijuana legalization movement in the 2018 governor's race. It made him a welcome guest recently at a new store called Herb RX in Sun Prairie, where Flynn learned about products made from the hemp-derived substance CBD.
And these edibles, what are these?
These are gummies, so you get four of these in the bag. They look like frogs.
Owner Jacob Coates doesn't sell anything containing THC, the compound that gives marijuana users a high. Flynn tells Coates that could change if he's elected because he wants to legalize marijuana and pardon anyone serving time for nonviolent marijuana offenses.
Maybe you'll be our first seller of marijuana.
Yeah,
legally.
That would be the best.
Legally.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, legally. Okay.
Flynn says pushing this issue wouldn't have been possible when he got his start in politics. And given how long ago that was, he might be right. Flynn, who's now 70, ran his first campaign for Congress in 1978 and became the first in a long line of Democrats to lose to Republican U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner.
It was a clearly Republican district, and I'm a Democrat, but in those days, I was 30 years old. So in those days, you know you're immortal.
Flynn became chair of the state Democratic Party from 1981 to 1985. In 1986, he ran for U.S. Senate, facing Ed Garvey in the Democratic primary. It was a combative race.
You know, it was basically like two Irish guys with short tempers and who could speak. And so we were going back and forth.
Flynn came up short, losing by fewer than 25,000 votes. In 1988, it seemed like the stars were aligning for Flynn. He now lived in a Democratic congressional district, and incumbent Congressman Jim Moody was leaving to run for U.S. Senate. So Flynn ran for Congress again with the support of Democrats like longtime U.S. Senator Bill Proxmire.
His name is Matt Flynn. Matt Flynn's among the most honorable, bright, and decent young men I've ever encountered in public life.
But things fell apart quickly when multimillionaire Herb Kohl decided to run for Senate. That drove Moody out of the Senate race. He went back to run for his old congressional seat and beat Flynn easily.
That happens. You know, Winston Churchill said that politics is just like war, except you can be killed 17 times. And so I've been killed probably 10 or 11 times, but I have some more lives left in me.
It would be 2004 before Flynn ran for office again. But by that time, he'd spent 15 years as the lawyer for the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, defending the Catholic Church against priest sexual abuse allegations. Flynn's work was an issue in that campaign, and he lost again. And as Flynn runs for governor in 2018, his work for the Archdiocese is resurfacing.
Yes, this absolutely disqualifies him from being governor.
Sarah Pearson of the group Women's March Wisconsin has helped publicize details of Flynn's work for the Archdiocese. That includes a $25,000 severance payment he oversaw to a priest convicted of sexual assault of a teenager. Pearson called on Flynn to drop out of the race.
As a leader of a progressive group, I know that in order to be successful in 2018, we need to put the strongest candidate forward, and Matt Flynn is not that person.
Flynn says that as a lawyer for the Archdiocese, he was doing his job.
I think any discerning person looks at this and says, Matt Flynn is one of the top lawyers in Wisconsin, and he handled these cases very well professionally. Somebody had to represent the Archdiocese, and I did it. And I'm very proud to have done it.
Flynn has been through all of this before. Asked what makes this campaign different, the longtime Democrat answers without a flinch. Compare him to the other candidates, Flynn says, and he's the best one. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We continue our coverage of the 2018 governor's race tomorrow at this time, and you can get more coverage at WPR.org. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman.